You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition. And it lies between the pit of one's fears and the summit of one's knowledge. You are now traveling through a dimension of imagination. You just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. I'm your host, Matt Hurt, and if this is your first time listening, Anthology is one man's examination of The Twilight Zone as a first-time viewer. Each podcast, I share my first impressions, analysis, and overall thoughts on Rod Serling's iconic series one episode at a time. However, in this bonus episode series, I'm reviewing Season 2 of Jordan Peele and Simon Kinberg's Twilight Zone reboot on CBS All Access, now called Paramount Plus, hosted by Jordan Peele. You can find more of Anthology as well as full episode archives at anthologypod.com. And if you want to contact me, you can use the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod, tweet me at @OVAnthologyPod, or send an email to matt@obsessiveviewer.com. Finally, if you want to support the show and get access to exclusive content, go to patreon.com/obsessiveviewer and pledge a minimum of $1 per month for an exclusive RSS feed with content recorded specifically for Patreon supporters, or you can pledge $5 for the exclusive RSS feed as well as commentary tracks and immediate reaction recordings that I do. And if you pledge $10, you get access to all of that and then early access to episodes and unreleased recordings. Again, that's at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. So today on the show, I'll be discussing Try. It's the 9th and penultimate episode of The Twilight Zone's second season, which premiered on June 25th, 2020 on CBS All Access, now known as Paramount Plus. And yeah, this is a really good episode. I'm very excited to talk about it. And I do have new equipment that I'm recording into. So if the audio is different, better, worse, whatever, let me know. I'm very, very excited about it. So you can find more about that on Patreon and everything. So yeah, so this is the penultimate episode of The Twilight Zone. This reboot is dead. It's not coming back. So this is technically the last time I'll be reviewing this episode or this series, this new Twilight Zone series, because I've actually already recorded and edited and prepped and everything my review of You Might Also Like, the 10th episode. That'll actually be popping up on the feed probably 2 days after you hear this episode. So yeah, we're finishing up The Twilight Zone, so that's exciting. Before I get into my review and everything, I'm going to just touch briefly on Paramount Plus. I'm recording this on March 7th, and Paramount Plus launched on March 4th. Paramount Plus is the... It's okay. It's mostly a rebranding of CBS All Access, but they're including a lot of different Paramount properties, I guess. Like they have a pretty sizable selection of stuff. They have Nickelodeon, MTV, Comedy Central, like all the back catalog of that stuff. So that's kind of cool. And the user interface on it's pretty neat. It's kind of reminiscent of Disney Plus, the way that that's set up with the different channels. And for that matter, HBO Max. So it's neat. It's cool. But I probably won't be subscribed to it after this month, which actually it's kind of neat because there is a 31-day free trial for new subscribers apparently. So, go check it out if you want to. And then, you can revisit The Twilight Zone and, revisit my reviews of them. So yeah. All right, let's get into this episode. So, again, this is episode 9, Try. I'm going to read a plot summary courtesy of the app for Paramount Plus. When the quick-witted Claudia has a chance run-in with Mark at a museum, he dazzles her with his seemingly miraculous abilities. But after the true source of his charisma is revealed, the encounter takes a dark turn. This episode stars Topher Grace as Mark. He was previously in, obviously, That 70s Show and Black Klansman, and he was also in an episode of Black Mirror. And co-starring as Claudia is Kylie Bunbury. She was in When They See Us on Netflix, and the short-lived, I believe, TV show on maybe Fox called Pitch. If memory serves, I think she played a young woman who like gets into the MLB. She becomes a professional baseball player. And I think that show lasted one season and had like flashbacks to her upbringing and how her father taught her how to pitch or something like that. I don't know. Writer for this episode was Alex Rubens, who was an executive producer on the show, and he also wrote A Human Face and Blurry Man and The Comedian. And director for this episode was Jennifer McGowan. She previously directed a movie called Rust Creek, which is about this is in 2018. It's about an overachieving college student gets lost on her way to a job interview. A wrong turn leaves her stranded deep in the Kentucky forest. So that sounds interesting. I haven't seen it, so I don't know. So those are the cast and crew rundown for this episode. My initial thoughts, first, by the way, spoilers on for Try Try, so I'm going to be spoiling the entire episode, so if you have not watched Try Try yet, go check it out, and then come back and listen to this episode. So, spoiler warning done, it's good, we're there, okay, so spoilers on for Try Try. My initial thoughts for this episode is that I was pretty blown away by it. It's a unique spin on Shadow Play. And it has this commentary on kind of the incel movement, which, and like nice guys, trademark, and different gender dynamics and stuff like that, social settings, social, like dating essentially. And I was very much into it, and it was very reminiscent of last season's, Not All Men, and the way that handled, the way that men and women interact socially. Not All Men was a bit more, well, way more on the nose and kind of direct in that approach. And what I appreciate about, and I liked Not All Men, I think. I liked it well enough. But Try does that, handles that a lot better, in my opinion. It's really cool. And it's a lot more subtle and indirect in its approach to it. So I really like that. Okay, so the episode opens up with close-ups of these indigenous masks that Claudia is working on her dissertation on. And, I mean, it's pretty overt symbolism about masks and disguising who we really are in social dynamics and everything. Like the way that Mark is presenting himself as the perfect guy when he's really a dangerous individual. So it's pretty overt. It's pretty on the nose. But I don't mind it because it's not like it's pointing out exactly in dialogue or anything like, oh, this is a mask that we all wear masks and everything. It's just a visual kind of, symbolism in the episode. So I like that. So Claudia is walking up the stairs from the subway, I believe, and she's recording onto her phone. And okay, so real quick, this is just a nitpick. I've got to say it. When she's talking into her phone, she's moving her hand a lot. And like, I get it. She's an actor. She has a prop in her hand. She's talking into it and everything. I get it. But like, the podcaster in me was just thinking like, all the wind from moving her hand, that's going to just affect the sound of the recording. And it's just, I don't know, it just really made me cringe a little bit. But it's not a reflection of anything in the episode, just a ridiculous observation I made. So as she's talking into the microphone, she mentions that she wants to explore how the masks that she's, you know, doing her dissertation on make people feel. And then she says, you can stand to let yourself feel things, Claudia. And I feel like that's an interesting, like, piece of exposition that's really, I wouldn't say almost to a fault, but it's definitely subtle in that it's kind of hinting at this moment, you might be inclined to think that it's hinting at maybe a past breakup that she hasn't gotten over, or it's more notably hinting at just too much work. She's a workaholic. She's doing too much for her dissertation and everything, and she's not doing enough socializing. So that sets up her receptiveness toward Mark's kind of advances and everything, and that's kind of laying the groundwork for what's to come. And then almost immediately after that, There's a little bit of dialogue where she talks about like immortality and like reincarnation, just kind of as an aside. I think that that's just kind of a little nod to the concept of the episode and everything. But immediately after that, she almost gets creamed by a Dingle moving truck. Of course, Dingle moving is a reference to Mr. Dingle the Strong from the original series, and we've previously seen the Dingle moving boxes in A Human Face. So I like that they're kind of doing this running thing there. It's a little bit better than, okay. So last time on the podcast, I couldn't remember what the previous use of Dingle was in the show. And I just remembered right now that it was in season one in, I can't remember the name of it, the episode with Jennifer Goodwin. But it was Dingle Ice Cream. Also they had that in The Comedian as well. And like, that doesn't make any sense. Like Dingle Moving Company makes a lot more sense. So I appreciate them for doing that. So he saves her, by pulling her off the curb as she's about to walk, into the street in the way of the truck. And there are a couple of very subtle things that Topher Grace does when he pulls her back. And I really like this. He immediately says like, oh, watch out. And then he apologizes. He says, oh, sorry. And then as soon as she turns to look at him, he puts his hands up, to kind of deliberately communicate that he's non-threatening. And this is just a really neat kind of visual cue that like it's subtle in the way that he is, we know in retrospect after the fact, we know that he is manipulating her and he's a very terrible person. So him doing that, like, on the first viewing, you don't really think much of it. You may even, have your defenses like lowered a little bit by his physical, his body language. But in retrospect, when you revisit this episode, like it's like, oh, he's already starting the manipulation and the just entitlement, or not entitlement, that comes later, but he's just starting his manipulating her into thinking that he is quote unquote the perfect guy. So as he walks away, she thanks him and says like, oh, this could have been a bad day. And then he says like, oh, the day is what you make it. And then she says into her phone, which I thought this was kind of goofy or kind of cheesy, but she says that she may have met her future husband. And, like, I thought it was kind of silly, but it shows the immediate attraction that she feels toward him. And I it's fine. Like, it's not, it doesn't detract from the episode, but I just thought that it was kind of a little silly and impulsive to an extent. Because I think most of the episode is him gradually building up this connection that he is orchestrating with her. And to have her immediately say like, oh, he's my future husband, seems just a little weird, or it seems a little counterintuitive to the nefarious and malevolent actions of Mark. Because the episode is completely about Mark orchestrating things so that he and Claudia can be together and can without her like knowledge or kind of consent in that sense. But to have her immediately say like, oh, he's my future husband, that seems kind of a little off. So the next scene, they're in the museum lobby and he is paying for his ticket when he sees her come up. And so this is the start, like this whole prologue is really well done in setting up this meet cute between Mark and Claudia, because he says like, oh yeah, also a ticket for Evel Knievel over there, kind of just starting this kind of cute back and forth between him and her. And she protests and everything, and he rationalizes it. I thought this was pretty cool, or pretty good. He was just like, oh, well, the transaction's already done, and I mean, technically, if you take it back, you're taking money from the museum, and you'd rob a museum. You're a monster. I just thought that was cute, and like the way that the scene progresses as they're going through the museum in this prologue is that they play up this awkward attraction really well. Like Topher Grace and I gotta scroll up and Kylie Bunbury are just really, they have such really good chemistry, and also the dialogue is just really above and beyond, I think. It really has the feeling of dipping into like a just genuine like romantic comedy scenario. And I've got to believe that that is completely intentional, because this is this awkward attraction that they have and the meet cute that they have in this prologue is obviously different from what's to come, but it's also just really, really well done. They really sell that kind of cute banter that they have. And it kind of progresses as Mark finds her talking into her phone, and he makes little cute jabs about how she's being pretentious, and then he starts talking about the book that he has, and he's like, oh, I'm out pretentiousing you. And they kind of spin that idea of them being pretentious in the museum into this cute banter. And in doing that, it just really works for me. I don't know. Something about it just really works for me. So then Mark recites a quote that she knows, and she like is very much smitten by and or appreciative of. It's someone's quote when giving a speech at the Nobel, I think is what he said. And up front, that's charming and it's interesting. But once you know the plot, it's just deeply disturbing and manipulative, because everything that he does is the outcome of countless tests that he did and tries that he had. And it's so good. I really love this conceit for this episode, which I'll talk more as the plot develops. So then Mark shows her masks, and that's when the watch beeps. And this is probably like 6 or 7 minutes into the episode. And this is the first time we get an inkling to what the Twilight Zone element of the episode is, which I found really interesting, because it just held back that, because it was so contingent on building up this attraction, this chemistry between these two characters before, you know, bringing in the Twilight Zone aspect of it. So his watch beeps, and he catches the water bottle that the kids throw that would have hit Claudia in the head. And that's our first inkling of the plot. And again, I just love how mysterious it all is and how slowly this Twilight Zone element to the story is unfurled. Because we still don't, even at this point, it's still a considerable amount of time. It's nearly halfway through the episode, I think, where we actually start to learn like the time loop aspect of it. So it's really interesting. And then we get the music playing and everything. And then we get Jordan Peele's opening narration, which I will play right now.
You might say that Claudia King has found herself on a kind of blind date. One set up not by friend, family, or co-worker. This is a match neither made in heaven nor the internet, but in the far darker web of the Twilight Zone.
And I like this opening narration. It's brief, and I don't really have much to say about it. It plays up the dating aspect of it and how this episode will become about dating dynamics and gender dynamics and everything within dating. Yeah, that's about all I have for that. it's a solid opening narration. I liked it. So we come back from the opening credits, and Mark is talking, Mark and Claudia are walking through the museum, and Mark is talking about New York, how he misses New York and the Museum of Natural History. And it's interesting because this line where he's like, oh, it just makes me think of New York, like that feels so, to the episode's credit, it feels so put upon, like it feels so not out of left field, but it feels like he is reaching for a topic. He's not struggling to make a connection, but he is making a quick connection, or like he's making a leap in the conversation, because it just seems like out of place, like suddenly he's talking about New York, because he is kind of orchestrating the conversation. But here's something that I found also very interesting, is that he mentions when talking about the Museum of Natural History, you've got to assume that he is leading up to talking about the canoe, and then that's when he's going to kind of get her into the canoe and everything, which I'll get to in a second. But at this moment, he mentions a specific part of the museum, something about a mound of dirt, I think, and that's when Claudia says that it was her favorite part of the museum too. And what I found interesting about this interaction is that this is where Mark first slips up, and he says, how is it that you still surprise me? And that's meaning that this exchange wasn't scripted by him. And I found it interesting because this is our first, like it's the first time he slipped up, and it's a scene that's opening the door a little bit more for the audience on the Twilight Zone element of the episode. And it's just the fact that it's a moment where Mark isn't in control. I just found that kind of interesting in a way, because we're along for the ride just as Claudia is, and we are getting little snippets here and there, but the biggest one so far is him slipping up, but we still don't know the context of it. So I don't know. I just found that pretty interesting. And then she realizes, like, oh shit, I don't know this guy's name, and asks him. And he says his name is Mark with a C. And this is an episode that just rewards multiple viewings, absolutely. Because when you go back and watch it again, it's just you pick up on so many, like, just disturbing little bits of the conversation. Now, of course, the Mark with a C thing will be called back later in the episode. But in this moment, when you replay it and rewatch it, there's such a level of disturbing to this moment, because we're to infer that he had a conversation with her about the name Mark, and he got the information about her thinking that the C in Mark was sexy. And this, I mean, this is confirmed later in the episode as he's kind of coming clean about everything. But just going, like, seeing this moment where he mentions Mark, he's Mark with a C, it's just, it's so disturbing how he's planned this moment specifically to get her to open up to him about that, and to associate him with a crush that she had when she was a kid. It's just, there's such a skeeviness to it, and just a, like, this is maybe not the start of his manipulation, but it is the furthering of his manipulation of her in this episode. It's just really just skeevy and unsettling or disturbing. And so as they're continuing on through the museum, this is when he starts to, and we start to realize, like, he's going to let her in on what's going on, essentially. Or maybe that's not the case. So he essentially shows her his power a little bit by offering her gum. And this is where in the narrative things are starting to slide from the meet cute to the hint of derangement that's to come. So I just found it interesting and mysterious is the word I'm looking for. Because he's just like, oh, do you want a piece of gum? And then the guy drops the gum right there. So it's starting to just show, like, there's something amiss and everything. But thinking about it through Claudia's perspective, she is someone who is kind of having a connection with this guy, and then suddenly she's realizing, like, oh, there's more to this guy that is potentially dangerous. Like, at this point, I don't know if she would necessarily think he's dangerous, and, like, specifically at this point, but there's something just super weird and out there about, you know, knowing when a guy's going to drop his gum. So that's the first hint of derangement that's to come and everything. So he then convinces her to get in the canoe with him. And this, again, everything, like, when you rewatch this episode, everything that he does is filtered through this, this danger and, manipulation, because him convincing her to get into the canoe with him, like, he prefaces it by saying, like, it's a replica, it's fine. And she's like, well, yeah, I know that it's a replica. If it wasn't, I would stop you. But he's so adamant about the security guard not turning around and everything, but him convincing her to get in the canoe is a calculated thing where it's dangerous, so there's a little bit of danger there to kind of heighten the adrenaline and everything. But it also brings this intimacy into their encounter, because they eventually, like, lay down in the canoe and are very close to each other. And it's so disturbing. I love that. It's such a disturbing kind of manipulation tactic on his part. So while they're in the canoe, they almost kiss, but she stops and asks to know his trick, because she says, you have a secret and you have to tell me before any funny business. So that's when they get out of the canoe, and he takes her off to come clean about it. There's a close-up shot when they get out of the canoe where, it's a close-up shot of his book and, like, a belt or something. I don't know what that was, but This doesn't come into play like at all. Like there's some close-ups to the books that he has, because each day he has a different book. But I don't really know why the camera focused so much on the book in the canoe, because it never came back into play or anything. I don't know. It was kind of just a little off. But I will say that I really like the music in this episode overall. But in this scene specifically, when they're getting out of the canoe, I thought it was really, really good in terms of just showing, like, I can't really describe the music itself, but it kind of goes a long way to gradually shift the tone of the episode, because this episode overall starts out with, like I said, this extended like meet cute that they have that is right out of like a romantic comedy, and then it just transitions into this dangerous and violent encounter at the end. So it's definitely playing with that tone a lot, and the music just subtly shifts us toward it. So I really appreciated the music in this episode. So he's still kind of playing coy about his trick and everything and his secret, and she playfully threatens to kick his ass if he doesn't tell her his secret, which I thought was cute. It was a neat piece of foreshadowing. I thought it was a good line to foreshadow the end encounter. But at this point, I don't know what I think. We're maybe 15, 20 minutes into this episode, and it's a 42-minute episode, and this is when Mark tells her the truth, but he's still pretty coy about it, and it's just, I really appreciate Kylie Bunbury's performance here, because he's saying these things that's just really off-putting. Like, he says, "You haven't met me, but I've met you," and that alone is just super unsettling and, like, just really creepy. And then he goes on to kind of say, like, "I know everything. Like, I'm, you know, an authority on today." He says that later. But he goes into this whole spiel about how he and Claudia are the same on a deep level, and that they're lucky in life, but instead inside they're caged. They're stuck in a cage, essentially, and they're trying to find a way out of the cage. And it's interesting that this can be seen as him trying to appeal to her attraction toward him before letting loose the truth. But on a kind of more deeper level, it's all about the power dynamic. He, in this situation, is holding every card in this interaction, and he is in complete control of her and their encounter, in a sense. And so it's so disturbing to me, because everything is calculated from him. And so he kind of pushes it a little bit too far, and he starts talking about her attraction toward assholes. And I felt like this crosses an extended line, because he's now speaking specifically about her feelings and emotions, and it comes across, and is intentionally so, or is the implication, is that he is continuing an intimate conversation that she had with him on one of the previous versions of the day, but this version of Claudia wasn't a part of it. So in that sense, by him talking about, like, "Oh, you're attracted to assholes, but you're not really attracted to assholes, you're just attracted to confident people, so you're attracted to people with confidence," and in that sense, it feels like it's a violation of her privacy, and it's even invasive toward her on an intimate level, because to an extent, she didn't consent to this type of, you know, intimacy in talking about her emotional baggage, essentially. And it's just, it's really, it comes across as kind of invasive and cutting corners with her, in a sense. It's just, it's really interesting. And another thing that I found really unique in this, I'm trying to not say interesting that much, but the next, kind of the next line, when he's still being coy about it, he talks about the piece of art that they're in front of, and it's this giant bird that's on top of a clam that has animals like stuck in it or hiding in it. And he says that the piece of art that they're sitting in front of is his favorite. And he talks about how the dominance and power of the bird over the animals is just really awe-inspiring to him, or what have you. And what I really liked was Claudia says that it's the exact opposite, like the bird is saving them. And like, okay, that, I mean, it's a pretty straightforward display of them having completely different interpretations of this piece of art, and it's showing like their real, like who they are as people. Like Claudia sees that the bird is saving them, and he sees that it's a power, a show of dominance and force for the bird. So it's pretty overt. It's pretty surface level. But what I really like was that this is a point where Mark, his kind of mask, this facade of nice guy trademark, is slipping and everything. And that's a really interesting, like, again, a little creak of the door, a little opening of the doorway into his psyche, into the doom or the threat that's kind of forming within him toward her slowly. I just think that the pacing and the structure of the tension throughout the episode is just really, really well done. So then she says he's starting to freak her out, but she doesn't say you're starting to freak me out exactly, because she prefaces it by saying that everything that he's saying, she's on board with. Like, she's like, everything you're saying, like, I'm into it. This is great. But you're also freaking me out. And I found that really interesting as social commentary on a very subtle level, because I don't know how intentional it is, but it feels like I think that there's an argument to be made that this is a subtle commentary on kind of gender dynamics. Like, the woman in the situation has to preface her comment about being freaked out by this man's behavior by reassuring the man that what he's saying is working. And the implication is that, you know, like, a woman can't say something negative to a man without, like, prefacing it by, you know, ruining or by softening the blow, because the implication is that the man might, you know, act out against her or be angry or what have you. It's an interesting kind of social commentary in this scene, I think. Just a very subtle, like, blink and you'll miss it kind of thing. I really liked that part of it. So he goes on to talk about how he's been working on this date for I don't even know how long. The number of tries is in the triple digits by now. And that this moment, when I first saw this episode, just the gears turned and everything clicked together, and it kind of blew my mind. I loved this, because this is the reveal that this is a time loop story. And one of my favorite episodes of the original series, of the episodes that I've covered, is Shadow Play from season 2. And what I love, it's so fascinating and fantastic to me that this episode of The Twilight Zone takes the concept of Shadow Play and flips it on its ear. So in Shadow Play, we go through a single loop of the story, and we go through it entirely through Adam Grant's perspective as the person in the time loop. And he's on death row, he's about to be executed and everything, and this is just one loop of his, like, looping time loop, endless loop. And in Try-Try, we go through a single loop of the story, but it's on the outside of the looper's perspective, and I love that. I love that so much. It presents this time loop aspect as a mystery, and by doing that, it's taking us into the perspective of a bystander or a victim of the time loop person, and that makes the entire, like, concept of the time loop be completely superfluous to the story, because this is the story of Claudia meeting Mark and realizing that Mark is dangerous and trying to escape Mark or get away from him. And if we had wasted more time with just setting up, like, oh, how many, like the mystery or the tension of the time loop aspect, like, he's not a tortured person in the time loop. He's just a very severely damaged and deranged person from the time loop. But trying to correct the time loop never becomes part of the story. And I think that that's really an interesting way to present this, concept for the episode. So she kind of continues a little bit of the flirtation stuff, and she's very quick-witted with him in a cynical way, and basically, in no uncertain terms, kind of reveals that she doesn't really believe him about it. So he rapid-fires facts about her, and he intersperses it with facts about the people around him and the day and everything. And while he's going through this, the camera just kind of spins around with them in the frame. And I really like it because it's very disorienting. And this is where she gets like overtly freaked out, like completely freaked out and calls him out on it. And he says that the being stuck in a time loop isn't so bad. I can basically do whatever I want. And I love that in the way that it's disturbing. Because again, it's just showing that he lives in a world without consequences. And with that, with no consequences, that means he is much more dangerous than really anyone else in this museum. But what I also thought was interesting is he says it's a life without consequences and a life out of the cage. And I thought that that was really kind of an interesting, not callback, but an interesting mirror of their conversation about the art with the bird. Because he sees his time loop as being outside the cage when it's kind of obviously the opposite. Like, the entire idea of being stuck in a time loop confines him to the parameters of a cage of a single day on an endless loop. But he sees it as a life out of the cage because he has complete control, no consequences. He can manipulate things to his liking. And that's just such a dangerous and disturbing mindset that I really appreciated. So then as she's kind of questioning him about it, she says that she's having trouble wrapping her head around it, around something. And then he interrupts her and says there's some, like, he says that he has thought about it a lot. He's had a ton of time to think about it, and some puzzles just aren't meant to be solved. And this is Mark mistakenly thinking that her confusion is about the concept of the loop. And again, it's interesting. This is kind of a jab or a subtle commentary about mansplaining, which is a term that I'm back and forth on. I talked about it in my Not All Men review because they brought up mansplaining in that, and it was more just overt and surface level. But here, like, this is just a really interesting, like, depiction of it and everything, I'll say. But it really brings to mind something that I really like about this episode, that confusion. Because he says, like, the line saying that there are some puzzles that aren't meant to be solved can be kind of a kind of throwaway kind of line with in context of the full episode. But what I really like about that, and what I like about the episode as a whole, is that there's really nothing special or unique about her specifically, about Claudia, in relation to the time loop. Like, he's not pursuing her because she's the key to getting himself out of the loop. Like, at the end of the episode, they kind of talk about that, and it's kind of dismissed a little bit, but he's still, like, he's not doing it because he needs to get out of the time loop. He is doing it because he's attracted to her, and he likes her, and he feels this sense of ownership over her and a sense of entitlement for her affection. For several reasons, but because he's done this every day for like thousands of days. And it's just, it's really refreshing to see a science fiction concept like this just be not cast aside, but just be in the background. Like, this is the concept of the episode, but what we're telling is a story about these two characters and the derangement of one character and the other character escaping that derangement. And it's just, it's a really interesting way to present the concept of the episode. And so now that he's explained the concept and everything, and that she's wise to the situation, the time loop stuff instantly loses its charm, like, by design. I love the goofiness of this to an extent. So he does this bit where he is basically doing this, this comedy routine in, like, an not atrium, but a room where a security guard has his back to him, and he picks up a paddle and he starts dancing with it and everything and pantomiming with it. And it's an interesting, like, just reversal of the tone of, like, the water bottle scene, the gum scene, the canoe stuff earlier in the episode. It's like the antithesis of those scenes, because now that we know, like, what he's up to and, like, how fractured he is, or how deranged he is, I keep using that word, but how deranged he is, like, we can see, like, okay, this stuff is not charming. Like, it's not a meet cute anymore. Like, this is sliding into dangerous territory. And a big part of that is obviously presenting him playing with the paddle and everything is silly on its surface. But it's just an interesting antithesis to those other scenes and everything. And she's freaking out. She's saying, like, you need to put it back. It's an artifact. It's important to people. And then he's just like, he's showboating. But it's just for his enjoyment. Like, this is, like, this isn't to manipulate her or anything. It's just, it's his pure enjoyment. And it's just, it says so much about that character and his derangement and everything. And her not being receptive to it just shows that she now sees him for what he is. And it's, he's an emotionally manipulative predator to her. And it's really interesting. And then he goes, he grossly violates her personal space by paddling her on the butt. And it's just, it's fascinating and really well done, because he pats her butt, and then she spins around and kind of gasps and jumps back a little bit in a defensive posture. And then he says, he immediately says, I knew you wouldn't mind that. I just know you so well. And it's just, he has no sense of boundaries, and his ability to read her discomfort is just, it leads really well into this transition into derangement, from like, I think I just met my future husband, to, oh my God, I'm going to need to get out of this situation. It's just, it's really great. And that, like, that was kind of a little bit of a shock, like him hitting her with the paddle. It's just like, that, like I said, it's a gross violation of her personal space. And also, even more shocking is, again, that inability to read the discomfort that she has toward him in that moment. And so he then says that he's kind of the perfect guy. And again, this is where the episode is getting, inching more and more toward the commentary about, like, incel community and nice guy ism and everything, which is something I find just incredibly cringy and ridiculous and dumb beyond all hope. So he's talking about how he's the perfect guy, and we see flashes of his previous days or his previous tries. And specifically, we see different versions of the truck, and one of them, he accidentally gets her killed, which I thought was pretty interesting. And then the other version of the flashes that come a couple moments later are him trying out different names for the masks, which that's fine. But she calls him out and says that you've been tricking me this whole time, and he kind of, like, he says, no, you don't understand. This is all for you. It's all about you. And that's just... that just makes it so much more disturbing. Like, it's the needle toward his derangement is just slowly moving in that direction. And it's just, it's really well done, the tension building in this. And it escalates. The conversation keeps escalating. And she asks, like, why are you doing this? And he says, because I love you. And it's just, it's really interesting, because we're seeing this version of the day for the first time, obviously, just like Claudia. So we're seeing this happen through Claudia's perspective, and we're meant to infer, and we know from this that he is being totally honest, presumably for the first time, about everything in this version of the day. And, but the reason that he's being totally honest is, not for any like nice reason. It's because he wants to be with her for real. Like, he wants all of her. And he has this idea, and he says that we belong together. And it's just like, this moment just cements this, that this episode is essentially every teenage lovelorn nice guy-ism distilled into a Twilight Zone episode. And for me, honestly, this is working like gangbusters. It is so engaging, and the commentary is so, like, well done, in my opinion, that I love this. Because it's not, like, attacking, or it's not, I wouldn't say it's not, I don't know if I would say it's not attacking, like, I keep saying, like, nice guy-ism, but, like, just asshole entitlement people. But it is more just shining a light on the behavior of people and the mentality of, like, the incel community, like, you know, and misogyny and everything, and just showing it for what it is. It's a harmful, corrosive personality trait, and it's really well done, in my opinion. So she's getting more, like, you know, indignant and everything, and starts and calls him out for being manipulative. And he says, this is when he says that the reason that he's in the time loop doesn't matter. What matters is his feelings for her, and that they belong together. And again, it's really a well done commentary, but it's interesting how he can't accept or understand that she doesn't reciprocate. Like, he doesn't care, because everything that he sees is filtered through his perspective on how much they are meant to be. So even though she doesn't reciprocate those feelings, he doesn't care, because those are, like, his feelings toward her supersede any feelings that she doesn't reciprocate. So it's just, it's this really just fucked up, frankly, dynamic that it's just really well done in this episode. And honestly, and I don't know, like, I'm really curious if anyone watched this episode and thought, like, oh, you know, Mark is right. Like, Mark has a point. Cause honestly, like, if anyone did that, you're objectively wrong. Like, it's just wrong. And it's even, like, it keeps doubling down. Every line of the conversations that they have kind of double down in these moments, because she says, like, she tells him, I don't feel comfortable right now. And then he dismisses that and says, like, wow, there's no romantic moment that you can't ruin. And it's just amazing to me, because he's unable to recognize her position in the situation, and he's not even cognizant of his role in making her feel this way. And in a sense, it kind of goes beyond, like, a mere God complex plot. Like, he's not showcasing his power, or he's not, like, using it for, I'm stopping short of saying for personal gain, but it's, I don't know, it feels more malevolent and insidious than that, in a sense, because it is targeting one specific person, and he is trying to manipulate his way into the heart of one specific person. It just feels like that feels just deranged and everything. And then he says the classic line. He says, you're lucky I'm nice. And nice guys, I just, God, it's a phenomenon that I am, it's insane. It's insanity to me. But anyway, so he says, you're lucky I'm nice. And she's like, well, what does that mean? And I don't know. I love the writing of this scene, because he tries to rationalize this threatening behavior that he has. Like, this, he says, you're lucky I'm nice, after he's whined about how he did everything right. I told you the truth. I came clean. I told you everything. And I told you I love you before, and you've said it back to me on previous days, but it didn't work this time, even though I did everything right. It's just, it's so, like I said, insidious behavior. It is just, it is derangement and self-delusion that is just so well done. Like, Topher Grace knocks this scene in this episode out of the park, I think. And so does Kylie Bunbury. They're both amazing in this episode. And so he starts kind of trying to rationalize his behavior and saying that, like, oh, these whole concepts of good and bad and everything, like, why do you think that all power really is bad? Because it's all just a value system. And she, I love this kind of the way that she just kind of totally shuts down and cuts down his argument. She just says, stop with the freshman philosophy. This isn't about a value system. All we are is what we do. So stop acting like a fucking creep. And I love that. And I love the way that she just explains, she goes on to explain in very clear and direct terms that the tries that he had and the attempts that the practice that he did wasn't with her. So this presents this interesting kind of disparity in their situation, essentially. So he has built up this relationship or this bond or this connection that they have over the course of thousands and thousands of days. And she is just someone who just met this guy. So it's just this, the power dynamic, the emotional dynamic between them is so lopsided. And he even goes on to say, or he may have already said it in the timeline of the episode, but he says, I've changed myself for you. Like, and that just blows my mind in a sense. Like, that is just so creepy because he, like, everything that he's done, like, this version of him that we're seeing is a vastly different version of Mark than the first one that was in the time loop, presumably. So him saying that he has changed himself, like, he's read the books and everything, he's read up on the stuff that she likes and everything, he's learned her points of interest and everything specifically to manipulate her. So he is presenting himself in a version of himself that's not himself. He has a mask just to manipulate her. It's just so fucked up and well done, in my opinion. And then we get a big turning point in this moment, in this episode. So she explains to him, like, I'm another human being. Like, you understand that, right? Like, I am another human being. And he just dismisses that and says, well, sort of. And he goes on to rationalize and saying, like, well, you know, when I wake up, when I go to bed and wake up, like, there's going to be another you. Like, you're not going to exist. There's just going to be another version of you. And he says in just this really creepy, casual way, he says, or he doesn't say it, like, he's implying that he can get away with anything. And she says that it could justify anything if you keep that line of thinking. And this is when he says this super chilling thing. He says, even if I killed you, there will be another one, another you here tomorrow. And it's just, it's so, so creepy and unsettling. Like, it is, like I said, a turning point in the episode. And then he also just kind of, like, this is a great moment because you can see the gears turning in his head. Like, he's thinking, like, I could do this. I could push this even further and actually kill her and I wouldn't have any consequences. And then as she's talking to him, he kind of flips out a little bit. He's like, no, let's change the subject. Let's change the subject. It's just, it's really just creepy. The way that, it plays out. And I mean, God, I love Topher Grace in this episode. I really highly recommend that you guys check out Black Klansman because he plays David Duke and he plays him as this sociopath and, just this charming evil person. And he plays that role really well. It's really great. So he starts chasing her and this moment's okay. Like, he's chasing her around, he's taunting her. It's kind of hokey. It's a little, like, it drags the episode just a tiny bit, because it just feels a little bit, I don't know. It seems a little bit manufactured. Maybe manufactured isn't the right term, but it kind of reminds me of, like, the chase scenes in Blurry Man last season, which was also written by Alex Rubens. But in Blurry Man, she's running through the set and everything, and it's just kind of, it seemed like it was just faux tension, essentially. And here it's kind of the same thing. Like, they're running around, he's chasing her. It just seems like the episode has built up so much goodwill in the dialogue and the tension built within that dialogue that to have them just become this chase scene through this museum is just kind of, I don't know, it just didn't really feel like it connected as well as the rest of the episode had. And so they kind of have a scuffle and she takes his watch. And I kind of like that. It's kind of It was an interesting moment because she takes the watch and then he's just like, "Oh no, my magic watch!" And he just explains like that has not like that's not going to do anything. It's just my cheat sheet. It's fine. So then they've run and he's been chasing her and everything, and that's when she's like, "Well, I'm going to have to kick your ass." Then he goes into this whole spiel about how he's going to like. Everything is going to reset and he's just going to do this again tomorrow or what have you. And she says, "Well, I'm going to have to kick your ass every single time then." And there's kind of an act break and we get the start of like, oh, they're going to fight. there's a line that I thought was really, really cool. Because they're about to start like she's, you know, building up her energy to fight him and everything. And she says, like, very sheepishly, she says, "I'm going to kick your ass into yesterday." And he undercuts that by just saying, "Well, you sound super confident about that." And then he's revealing, like, his true self, essentially. And he talks about how, "I'm a man, I dominate and everything. Men dominate. That's just the way that the world works and everything." And it's the incel movement, essentially. And it's just... I love that. Like, I love how it just shows how just dangerous and deranged that thinking is. And the entitlement of it and the threat from it is just really good for the tension of the scene in general. Like, this combination of, like, well... I have feelings for you, so I'm owed this. Like, you owe me... whatever I want because I'm a man and I dominate. It's really, really good at creating and escalating the tension of the episode. The tension of the scene that's been mounting the whole episode. And again, this is just a really interesting companion episode to Not All Men, from season one. It's an interesting kind of, juxtaposition of those two episodes complement each other really interestingly. And so the fight is about to start, and this again is kind of hokey and kind of weird. He puts on a mask and he takes a weapon. Everything that he says is super creepy and threatening and everything, but just the way, like him wearing the mask, it just seems a little goofy and out of place, I think. He's kind of monologuing like a villain, which, whatever. So, as he's talking, she punches him in the face, and it's so satisfying to see her just beat the shit out of him. Like, the production, it feels like the show just made the sound effect of her punching his face land so much, so heavy in the soundtrack. Like, it is louder than you would expect, and it just creates this very satisfying thing because, you know, she's escaping this just deranged person. And then again, kind of hokey, the guards kind of come up and like, not to save the day, but it's just like they're waiting in the wings and oh, she's beat him up, so we're gonna go to her rescue now. It's just, it felt a little awkward. And as he's being kind of dragged away, he's like, "You're not gonna remember today, and I'm gonna come after the next Claudia tomorrow. And like, when I go to sleep, I'm going to wake up and I'm going to come after her, and I'm going to come after her again and again and again, and everything." And it's just like this impotent rage or this impotent threat from him, because he has been completely dismantled and cut down. And that's when, like, her only response is to punch him again. And then she says that she thinks that they'll be able to handle themselves. And I thought that was pretty cool. That was a good, like, button on that scene of the big confrontation scene. And so the episode is reaching its end, because we see the next day and we see her on the or we see him on the curb or on the sidewalk, like looking at her, glancing over at her as she's about to cross the street. And he doesn't approach her. And we see confirmation that she didn't need him to save her from the truck, because she was never going to get hit by the truck, obviously. And that was just a manufactured thing early in the episode. And it's interesting to see that she got through to him. Like, that leaves it on a pretty, I don't know, optimistic note, I guess. in a sense. So I thought that was interesting. And so then we get Jordan Peele's closing narration, which I will play right now.
Claudia King will, like most of us, proceed directly to a lifetime of tomorrows, leaving Mark Wheeler to spend an eternity in a prison of his own design. The inability, no matter how many tries he's given, to see beyond himself. An endless loop of solitary confinement here in the Twilight Zone.
And that's the end of the episode. I really like the closing narration. I like how I like how brief and succinct it is, but also I really like the how it likens Mark's situation to being in a prison, like him being spend eternity in a prison of his own design and an endless loop of solitary confinement. I feel like that's a nice little nod to Shadowplay because I was set in a prison and everything. So overall I think that this episode is one of the strongest of season two. I still think that a small town is my favorite, but I think that this would be a very close second. It's a really great great episode, great message. There's subtlety in it that that I feel worked really well, and just the tone or the pacing of it and the escalation of the tension and the shift in tone from meet cute to thriller was really good. I really, really like this episode. So those are my thoughts on Try. Let me know what you guys thought of this episode. You can obviously send me a message on Facebook or send me an email at matt@obsessedviewer.com. And so that'll do it for this episode. Next time, like I said earlier, in a couple of days probably, you'll see the next episode of the podcast pop up. It'll be my review of the final episode of season two of The Twilight Zone, and also the final episode of The Twilight Zone 2019, like this version of The Twilight Zone, because it was canceled. That was recorded, like I said, in June of last year, so there might be some interesting discrepancies there or what have you. I'm not sure, but just kind of keep that in mind. So we're going to close out the season of these bonus reviews, and then finally, I'm going to get to season three of the original series. So thank you guys so much for sticking with me as I work through these bonus episodes and everything, and through all the hiatuses and everything. So I'm super excited to get back to the original series. Once again, this episode is recorded on a new piece of equipment. So let me know if the audio quality is good, improved, or what have you. Super excited about it. And really excited to do more podcasting with it. So that'll do it for this episode of Anthology. Check out my other shows, Obsessive Viewer and Tower Junkies. And also check out Patreon, patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. Next time I'll talk about... you might also like. And thank you guys so much for listening. And I'll see you next time. And now, here's a short clip from our Patreon-exclusive RSS feed. To hear the full clip and more exclusive Patreon content, go to patreon.com/obsessiveviewer and become a patron at the minimum rate of $1 per month. Thank you and enjoy! Speaking of Disney+, though, I have been watching WandaVision, and that'll be kind of the science fiction stuff that I talk about here in this episode. This Patreon episode. So, WandaVision, I'm 6 episodes in. And man, I love this show so much. I know that it's already aired all the episodes and that everyone's already seen them and everything. So I'm behind on it. I'm going to try to get Mike on for Obsessive Viewer to talk about it soon, this week, hopefully. But it's so good. It's so, so freaking good. I love that this is the MCU just going just super weird and super out there. I love that for it, and in particular, episode 4 is To put it delicately without spoiling it, episode 4 kind of takes us out of the concept of the show. So the concept is Wanda and Vision are in a sitcom environment, and every episode is like another decade of a sitcom. So the first one is it's like a 50s set sitcom. The next episode is 60s, 70s, 80s, so forth. So the fourth episode breaks that mold and shows us what's going on outside of the limitations of that sitcom formula and concept. And like, I was just so overjoyed by it because first, there's some returning characters from the MCU that pop up in that episode, which I really enjoyed. But also because they present it, they present this like anomaly as they're kind of investigating it. They're looking, they're discovering what's going on, or they're trying to discover what's going on with the with essentially what's going on. And the way that it's presented plays out so much like it's like the MCU riffing on the Twilight Zone or the X-Files, and I adore it for that. I think like it just it filled my heart with so much joy. I really loved it. So I'm 6 episodes in. It's going some very interesting places.
Anthology is edited and produced by Matt Hurt and presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. For a full archive of our episodes, go to anthologypod.com/archive. You can also like the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod and follow the show on Twitter at @OVAnthologyPod. If you enjoy the show, please take a couple minutes to leave us a rating and a quick review on Apple Podcasts. This is the easiest way to support what we do, and all it costs is a little bit of your time. If you'd like to donate to the podcast, you can make a PayPal donation at anthologypod.com/donate or support us on Patreon for recurring donations and access to commentary tracks and B-roll audio recorded exclusively for patrons at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. Every donation goes toward paying the fees to keep the podcast running and is greatly appreciated. Official Anthology merch, including shirts, mugs, phone cases, and more, can be found in the Obsessive Viewers TeePublic store. You can find a link to the store in the show notes of this episode and at anthologypod.com/donate. Or you can simply search for Obsessive Viewer at teepublic.com. For information about the Obsessive Viewer's annual live event showcasing short horror films from local filmmakers, check out shocktoberinirvington.com. And for an archive of all our events, as well as news about potential future events, head over to obsessiveviewer.com/live. For more podcast content, you can find our flagship movie and TV review and discussion show, The Obsessive Viewer Podcast, at obsessiveviewer.com and on Twitter at @obsessiveviewer. You can also find Tower Junkies, a podcast where Matt and co-host Tiny share their love of all things Stephen King and his magnum opus, The Dark Tower series, over at towerjunkiespod.com and at towerjunkiespod on Twitter. And finally, check out The Secular Perspective, Tiny's side project podcast, which tackles current events and life's big questions from the perspective of secular hosts Chad and Amanda at thesecularperspective.com. Bumper music for this podcast comes courtesy of As Good As It Gets, which can be found at facebook.com/asgoodasitgetsband. You can also find As Good As It Gets music on Spotify, Google Play, and iTunes. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Kitty!
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.